very really glad to have the opportunity to talk to you about my relationship with Bhante Sangharakshita. But it is a bit strange to talk about my relationship with Bhante Sangharakshita. Because, in a sense, I don't know the man at all. But that's clearly not what I'm here to talk about. I'm talking about Bhante as my teacher. I'm talking about Bhante as my inspiration. I'm talking about Bhante as the reason why I've completely and utterly and totally changed my whole life. If you'd met me, which you might have done in Croydon High Street 30 years ago, you'd have met a very different woman. And some people have known me for almost that long. Actually, he's the only one here, but and it is extraordinary how much we've changed. So I want to talk a little bit about that. But just before we start, I called this talk, when I was thinking about it, a personal taste of freedom. There's a nice little book called The Taste of Freedom, which I like very much, and I suggest you have a look at it if you don't know it. So it's three talks by Bhante. And I wondered, first of all, when you think of freedom, what do you think? You think it's a good thing? You'd like some more of it? Yeah, everybody's nodding who's doing anything. So you'd like a bit more of it. I tell you what, just turn to the person next door and you've got about 1 minute to make about 8 or 10 words. What does freedom mean to you? Ready, steady, go. Can everybody find someone to talk to? It could be a three, it could be a three. If you turn the other way, so you find one. So make sure everybody said something. Okay, it's a little lull. Thank you. So I'm going to collect 8 words. Just shout one out.
Infinite. Flying.
Expansive.
Liberation.
Responsibility.
Lovely.
Choice.
Freedom from choice.
Last word.
Not hemmed in.
Thank you very much. So we've obviously got a kind of picture of what we mean by freedom. For me, I was just kind of tossing a few ideas about and thinking, in our contemporary society, we have this notion of individuality and that we want to have the freedom to develop our individuality. That seems to be very important. We also want to be free to be who we want. And we also, let's be frank about it, we want to be free to have what we like. So all of those things really require us to have a fairly clear idea of who we are and who we'd like to be. And who we like to be has very much for me changed because of my study of Bhante Sangharakshita his life and his work. Because I can promise you what I would have liked to have been is not what I've ended up being. But I am much, much, much more happy. I could even say I'm a joyful person quite a lot of the time. I feel much more fulfilled. So I'm a good advert for the work of Bhante Sangharakshita. And I'll tell you what seems to me to be the most important. I'm giving you the punchline first so you can go away now if you like. I am free of some of the limitations and the boundaries of my oppressive self-absorption. I'm going to say that again. I am free of some of the limitations and boundaries of my oppressive self-absorption. And it used to drive me bonkers. It used to be that, you know, I was just kind of completely locked up. I know what they think of me, and I don't like it. And I want that person to really, really love me. And maybe they're not loving me, and I don't like it. And then so me and Deep actually got friendly. And she and I are very, very different because I always didn't like it and felt sad. And she always thought it was really lovely and wanted more of it. So we were kind of like two ends of a sort of a continuum. And I used to talk about that as she was a real going for refuge person. She thought, oh, look at these lovely people in the Sangha. Yeah, I want more of that. And I was thinking, oh, actually talk to that person a lot, and then anyway I'm feeling so sad. So I was a kind of going forth person because I was always trying to move away from the pain of being me, my oppressive self-absorption. So, you know, you can think about that in yourself. Are you a person who's drawn to things because you just think, oh, it's lovely, I like these people, I want more and more and more? Or are you a person who, well, it's not only people, it's coffee, it's cigarettes, sorry. it's things that
they're still legal.
Cigarettes. But she doesn't do it anymore. And she hasn't done it for donkey's years. But she did, and so did I. And are you recording this? Stick to the text. And then I don't hear. So I just thought, calling this to a personal taste of freedom, because I think it's because of that little book which I love, but also in order to be free in those wonderful words that you said, in a sense we really need to be very clear who we are and truly what we want, and I think that's what we're looking at here when we come to practice as Buddhists, when we practice together. So obviously, the first step is being aware of what's actually happening right now. So if you take the practice we just did together now, the Metta Bhavana practice, we started off, didn't we, just noticing how we are in our bodies. And there's only this body, when you think about it, to receive the world. Each of you has only the one body that you've got. You've only got the senses that you've got. That is how you receive the world. There's nothing else. So you're doing your own work and you're trying to get more and more clear about who you are, what you want and why you want it, to refine and deepen that in the light of some very, very, very big ideals, if we're sitting at the foot of the Buddha. Anyway, when I first came across Bhante Sangharakshita, it was in the context of groups of friendships and meditation around the London Buddhist Centre. I turned up at the beginner's class there in 1988, 10 years after the beginning of the London Buddhist Centre. So Bhante, in those days, actually lived in a flat which is upstairs, now part of the office at the London Buddhist Centre. So we used to quite often see him. And he was present but quite distant. I remember I used to volunteer in the restaurant downstairs, and I was asked to take him his lunch on Tuesdays, and I really seriously used to hope that he's not going to speak to me, is he? Because I felt really a mixture of awe and diffidence. We were talking about this in the car on the way up, you know, massive projection like he was. I didn't really know what on earth I could say to him. However, eventually I did overcome my self-consciousness, and I wrote to him and asked to become a Mitra, a friend of the movement. And he sent a card back, because I'd said, I don't know whether an Italian-speaking musical person who loves Indian music could actually do anything in the FWBO, as it was in those days. And he said, oh, well, practice the Dharma, and it helps you to make sense of your life. And that's what I'm saying to you, really. Ever since that postcard, my study of Bhante Sangharaksha's work has helped me to make sense of my life. When I first saw him, I must say I was very surprised. I saw him walking up Globe Road. There's this rather elderly gentleman in a tweed jacket, walking slowly and deliberately, holding a bottle of Neil's Yard shampoo. He didn't look at all charismatic. He's a most unlikely figurehead for an international Buddhist movement, which I began to realize was changing, challenging at least, many of the underlying assumptions of our society. So people of my generation observed him from the outside, and we were taught at the center by the disciples of his disciples quite often. So we didn't really get much opportunity to be taught by Bhante himself, but his disciples had taught their disciples, and they taught us. I mean, I use the word disciples in the sense of the people who were very close to him taught the people who were close to them, and then they taught us. So already, even at that time, 1988, Bhante himself had pulled back quite a lot from the Sangha as we know it, you know, the people who come to centres and stuff. And he did that around in the mid-1970s, around the time that the London Buddhist Centre was created. And I think all the way along you get this kind of intuitive understanding when you look at Bhante and his life of how things evolve. He himself would say he was a very unlikely person to be the leader of a new movement. But one can see, if you read his memoirs, that every time there was the need for some major change, he kind of intuitively had that grasp. And I know Dharmadina has come to talk to you, but I remember speaking to her about what it was like when Bhante did pull back. I mean, basically, Dharmadina took on leading pretty well every retreat that happened at the London Buddhist Centre for a while. And the only time she wasn't leading classes, or part of the team at any rate, was when she went on a solitary. But they had so little money and so little resources that, I mean, she was describing to me how it was that she'd have a tin of baked beans that had to last 2 days. And I am struck by the dedication and the commitment of those people at the beginning of our movement, and how they were sustained by their contact with Bhante. They were so inspired that they basically just handed over their lives to the movement. Nowadays, we are in a situation where we've got a lot more latitude, I have to say. And, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages of that. But in those days, the people who led things were so astoundingly committed. And when I think about that, I just have such a sense of gratitude to them, what they've managed to do and what they've actually helped us to do as a result. So what was it then that kind of triggered Bhante Sangharaksha, Denny Slingwood as he was, the man from Tooting, to, not so far from here, to start a Buddhist movement? How bizarre! Well, as you probably know by now, but it's so important, I want to tell you again. at the age of 16 or 17 with no guide or teacher to support him. What did he read?
The
Diamond Sutra. So this is what he wrote about that. When I read the Diamond Sutra, 16-year-old boy from Tooting. Get the picture. When I read the Diamond Sutra, I knew I was a Buddhist. Do you know any 16-year-old boys? You remember being 16 yourself? Come across the Diamond Sutra. Yep, I'm a Buddhist. Though this book epitomizes a teaching of such rarefied sublimity that even dedicated followers of the Buddha, arahants, are said to become confused and afraid when they hear it for the first time, I at once joyfully embraced it with an unqualified acceptance and assent. To me, the Diamond Sutra was not new. I had known it and believed it and realized it ages before, and the reading of the sutra, as it were, awoke me to the existence of something I'd forgotten. This is exactly what we were talking about in the tea break, wasn't it? The existence of something I'd forgotten. Once I realized that I was a Buddhist, it seemed that I had always been one, that it was the most natural thing in the world to be, and that I had never been anything else. Whenever I read the text, I would be thrown into a kind of ecstasy. I find that very inspiring to read. By the age of 19, there was Dennis Lingwood, as he was, in India with the signals unit of the British Army, and after the war he remained in India, searching for a way to live, his going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So Bhante's memoirs tell something of this journey, and he does say if you really want to get to know him that you should read them. They're quite interesting to read, I must say. But again, for me, it's not really his memoirs that tell me about him. It's not really his poetry either. It's his writing about the Dharma that tells me about him, and I'll come on to say more about that in a while. But just to connect again with the sense of dedication and astounding single-mindedness and certainty that this young man had when he decided that he was going to just finish his connection with the British Army. He just decided he was going to walk the length and breadth of India. So he travelled mainly on foot. He stayed in caves or semi-derelict viharas and temples. He lived on alms food or a very restrictive diet. 2 weeks of tapioca root. Actually, tapioca root's called sabudana, and I really love it. But it has to be cooked really well. I spend quite a lot of time in India. Do you know sabudana? It's like tapioca, but not a milk pudding. It's savoury. It's lovely. But I expect that the sabudana that Bhante got was probably not that well cooked. I think they were cooking it themselves on some kind of rudimentary little fire they made. So his purpose was to travel from the southernmost tip of India up to the Himalayas, preparing and finding a way to get ordained as a Buddhist monk. So he decided that's what he was going to do. It moves me to think of Bhante's zeal and commitment. He was very young and yet so mature and clear in his aspiration. And all the way along this path, he met with people searching for this ideal that he himself had sort of understood, how to become a practicing Buddhist. So he didn't meet that many Buddhists quite often, but he writes, "A prayer went forth from my heart. I prayed that not only in this land, but in every land, people might hearken to the voice of the Buddha. I prayed that they might set their feet on the path leading to their own and others' enlightenment. I prayed that I too might one day be enabled to help in some way towards this end." So right back there when he was wandering around in India, he had this sense that he wanted to get people to be able to practice the Buddha. Even before he could practice Buddhism himself, he had that sense. It is quite extraordinary. I don't know, I spend quite a lot of my life wandering around thinking, yeah, what do I want to do? What do I want to do about that? Oh, I don't know. I mean, even yesterday when my poor old dad was in A&E at King's College Hospital, you know, do we want him to be admitted? Should we try to take him home? I really couldn't tell. And a lot of our lives are like that, aren't they? We don't really know what we want to do. And why is that? Probably we don't know ourselves well enough. So we've got to keep this coming back, spending time, finding out who are we, what do we want, and why do we want it? Anyway, I love this little bit, so I want to read you this as well. He went to see this great teacher, Hindu teacher Ram Dass, who's quite well known. And this Ram Dass was famous for giving people mantra initiations. And Bhante said, I wanted a Buddhist mantra. And Ram Dass was a great believer in the efficacy of the Ram mantra. So Bhante was thinking, actually, he's probably going to get me to chant Ram, 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 like a lot of Ram followers of Rama do. He had never been known to initiate anyone into any other mantra. However, I need not have worried. He jumped from his chair and, raising his hand in an initiatory gesture, exclaimed, your mantra is Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Whose mantra is that? Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara, what is the significance of Avalokiteshvara in our movement?
Compassion.
Compassion. A thousand arms. Yeah. And did you know that it's one of the symbols that Bhante used eventually for our order? That each of us in the order becomes an arm of Avalokiteshvara, reaching out into the world as best we can, with compassion to meet the needs of the world, to meet the cries of the world. So there you are. He got his first Buddhist mantra from a Hindu teacher who never gave Buddhist mantras. Isn't that amazing? So when you take a step towards the universe, guess what? The universe takes a step towards you. So you can see here we are, Bhante, getting clearer about his Dharma path in all sorts of ways. Anyway, eventually, Bhante, I want to say a little bit about him now as a teacher. I myself have spent most of my life being a teacher, and nowadays I don't do it anymore, so that's quite nice. But, you know, I was a teacher of music for a long time, and I'm also fascinated by people learning things. And when you think about the qualities of a good teacher, what is really important is that the person is just fascinated to know who's learning what. In other words, you need to be nosy to be a good teacher, I think. But certainly, to put it in a bit of a more Bhante appropriate way, you need to be interested in what's coming back from the people that you're teaching with, which is an aspect of friendship as well, of course. So that receptivity and responsiveness was very much part of Bhante's own character. And when he had spent all those years in Kalimpong, in northern India, which you probably heard about in other talks, his teacher there suddenly said to him, actually, what you need to do now is to go back to Britain and teach Buddhism in Britain. So what did Bhante do? Came to Britain. And he had a really difficult time as well, because British Buddhism was a little bit different from our movement and order now. He encountered great troubles and conflict from the established British Buddhists. They weren't willing to accept him, and they weren't that interested in his approach initially. But he intuitively knew that what people needed was a live, emotionally engaged way to practice Buddhism. But the English Sangha Trust was really not set up in that way at all. It was much more like studying Buddhism and to do with middle class respectability in Hampstead. And However, by the end of the 1960s, we read that Bandhead managed to attract and inspire a growing number of young intellectuals who were reaching out and searching for meaning and truth. I mean, they weren't all clever, but there were surprising numbers of them that had Oxbridge degrees or worked for the BBC and things like that. But they recognised this strange man as their teacher and guide and their friend. So we have to picture Bhante Sangharakshita at this stage. He'd come back from India. He'd walked into Flower Power Hippiedom. He hadn't been in the West that much for 20 years. And when he left, everybody was wearing a tweed jacket and, you know, behaving in the way they did around the time of the Second World War. You think about what people looked like at the end of the 30s and what they looked like at the end of the 60s. Bit different. And we see again this kind of interest and curiosity about how... What's making these people tick? What do they want? How are they interested? And to get to know these things, what did Bhante Sangharakshita do? Grew his long sideboards, sideburns. What did we used to call them? Not sideboards, sideburns. But there's this picture of long hair, so not a beard, but it's long bits here. Sometimes he did wear his robes and then eventually took off his robes and started to live a lifestyle alongside this group of people who saw him as their teacher and friend. I'm struck that the kind of friendships that he formed were extraordinarily powerful. And that people were very, very committed to Bhante. And they really were inspired by him and trusted him. And there were some difficulties also that I'm sure those of you who've looked at the history of the movement are aware of. There were difficulties, there were problems, there were experimentations that nowadays we'd sort of think, my goodness, what did they think they were doing? But speaking as someone who came through that time myself, the late 60s and early 70s were a time of astounding experimentation socially. And we did behave in ways that now, when I think of how I was, I'm aghast and occasionally appalled. So in the movement, those things were happening. And we have to come to a personal accommodation with that. If you want to join the order, you have to look at what was going on there and you have to work out for yourself, well, what do you think and how are you with it? And, you know, sometimes in my Mitra study group, I get people coming around and saying to me, well, what did Bhante think he was doing when this happened or that happened? We talk about it, we're very, very happy to speak openly about what we know of that time. But I think you need to see this whole time, this history, this change in society that was taking place at that time, and the searching and experimentation that was breaking down some of the old order of middle class, particularly society in Britain, and allowing something new to emerge. I'm not going to say much more about that because it's not my personal experience, and there are others who will talk to you who maybe have had more to say. But one thing that we can see is that as a result of the interaction with Bhante himself as a teacher, people were empowered to do the most courageous things, particularly going off all over the world and setting up Buddhist centres. I mean, can you imagine yourself, and it could be any one of us, all ages did it, deciding, yeah, there's no Buddhist centre in Finland. Oh, there's no Buddhist centre in South Africa. Oh, there's no Buddhist centre in Estonia. Goodness, there's no Buddhist centre in San Francisco. Oh, there's no Buddhist centre in Paris. Okay, I'm off. Cheerio, leave my friends. Will you come with me? Yeah, but only for 6 months. All right, that'll do. And people going out all over the place and doing this astoundingly innovative work. Can you imagine yourself finding the courage to do it? I've sometimes contemplated it, but I've never done it, and I suspect there's a good reason for that. I don't think I have the... Anyway, I don't know. So certainly what was needed was a lot of trust and inspiration, and also just teaching, you know, how to speak, how to give a talk. There were these, like, speaker's classes and... you know, how to introduce yourself to the, how to, where to start with the Dharma. I mean, all those things were taught. And encouragement and close friendship to inspire and develop trust. So there's a little quote here from Nagabodhi, who was one of Bhante's first followers. He says, Bhante is a man who really wants to share himself with others. Whatever physical, psychological, or spiritual distance separates us from him should not lure us into the mistaken idea that he inhabits an ivory tower of self-sufficiency. So he's not withdrawn and sort of all certain. Sangharakshita places an exceptionally high value on friendship, not merely as an ideal, but as a lived day-to-day reality. As I said to you, I started to meditate in the company of friends. One of my dearest friends is right here. And what we found when we came along was that there are all sorts of backgrounds and interests by that stage in the late 80s. All sorts of ages, all sorts of cultural backgrounds. And we were all drawn to the same set of ideals. And in 1990... out came this wondrous book, and we all gave it to each other for our birthday presents, and we all studied it together. It was called Vision and Transformation. Vision and Transformation is now called Guide to the Noble Eightfold Path. So I don't know whether you can see, but at that time it was absolutely revolutionary for us. We hadn't got a book like that. When we wanted to do study for Mitra study, we had to play these little cassette tapes of Bhante having given a talk for a long, long time ago. And if you remember the cassette tape, it used to kind of stretch. That was our experience of studying the Dharma. So nowadays you've got a completely different set of tools at your disposal, particularly Free Buddhist Audio. Fantastic resource. But anyway, there we are. We were reading Vision and Transformation. And for myself, that book really changed my life. When I read it, I realised that I had probably been a Buddhist for most of my 37 years, as I was at that stage. And we really all felt a kind of excitement about, you know, what was it? What did really inspire us? What was it in this business that was like a vision for us? And then... transformation set in. Who really were we? What did we really want? And how were we really going to achieve it? So that, for me, the effect of that was really massive. In my first kind of spiritual experience was a realization that I'd been subject to my own bad moods all the time. You know, that I kind of didn't really know how to work with my own mental unrest, unhappiness, and emotional turmoil. So I realized I didn't need to be a victim of that anymore. That there was something else I could do. And that really turned my life around. It's a bit like, I suppose, I wasn't exactly depressed, but I was very anxious, and I think probably quite negative. And certainly it was very helpful to do that study in the company of good friends. So for me, that was the first of my experiences of a taste of freedom. Freedom to grow into the person I really wanted to be. And to take responsibility for myself in the process. That lady over there said responsibility was one of the aspects of freedom that she... was telling us about, mentioned. Nobody could do it for me. At the same time, I could not do it alone. And I realised the extent to which I was probably a bit disconnected and alienated from other people. And that I needed to take support. So it's quite interesting. I wondered whether to tell you a little bit about my time in India, but I think I probably won't. Just to say that I'd first learnt to meditate because I had been in India and I'd studied Indian classical music and Indian singing in India. And brought that back to London comprehensive schools where I was a music teacher. But while I was in India, I just met these people who were meditators, Hindu meditators actually. And I came back looking for people I could meditate with because I could see that it was, I was just drawn towards it without really quite knowing why. And eventually found the FWBO as it was. Just to tell you though, I mean, my contact with India has remained to this day. I work for the Karuna Trust still 2 days a week, and I go to India twice a year. So, and I really love being in India. It's kind of, I speak a bit of Hindi. I love Indian clothes and food, and my friends in India are very dear to me. And it just so happened that my first Indian teacher died, and then I found there was another Indian singing teacher that I wanted to study with, and he worked in Pune. And you might know that Pune is the centre for a lot of our Tri Ratna projects that we fund in India. So Pune is quite a key place for me in my life these days. When I went to visit Bante, I was talking to him about various things, and I said to him, you know, about my work in India and how important it was to me. And he, of course, had been involved in the whole development of these projects in India as a result of his time there, learning about the Dharma. I asked him if there was anything left in his life that he felt he would change, he wanted to change, something he'd like to have done that he didn't do. And he said, yes, I'd like to have been able to do more for the ex-untouchable Buddhist people living in India. So Bhante said that maybe 10 years ago, I'd like to have been able to do more. But actually what he did for the ex-untouchable people in India is inestimable. First of all, he got friendly with Ambedkar, who was their great hero, who led up a whole kind of succession of mass conversions. So millions and millions and millions of people converted out of Hinduism into Buddhism. Not directly because of Bhante, but he had a friendship and connection with Ambedkar. And at the time when Ambedkar, this great social leader, died, Bhante happened to be there in India. So Ambedkar had died, these millions of new Buddhists had lost their leader, and they were devastated. They were so confused and did not know which way to go. I'll read this quote to you because it's so beautiful. It was a scene of unmitigated despair and utter dejection. A great crowd had gathered, but no one could control their tears and despondency. Bhante Sangrakshita was there, and he began to speak. He offered much-needed encouragement. He talked mainly about Buddhism, telling his stunned listeners that their duty to Ambedkar was now to try to understand and to practice Buddhism. Dr. Ambedkar is not dead. He lives on and will live on in the hearts of his followers. His work will not come to an end. It will be carried on by each one of you. Now, to this day, if you go into one of our projects funded through the Karuna Trust in India, you'll see they'll be somewhere like in a hostel or in a kind of little slums settlement where they've got some classes. You'll see a shrine looking quite often quite like this. It's nice Indian cloth here. And on the shrine, there'll be a picture. Well, there'll probably be a Buddha at the top. Then there'll be a picture of Dr. Ambedkar. And there'll be a picture of Bhante Sangrakshita. So even if you go into a tiny little hutment in a slum from one of our new Buddhist brothers or sisters, you'll see a little photo of Ambedkar and a little photo of Bhante Sangrakshita. Isn't that amazing? So they might not even have a roof, but they'll have those two things. Now, you might think, well, she hasn't really talked that much about Bhante Sangharakshita. She's talked a lot about herself. And maybe that's because Bhante the man, I have to say, he's not someone I know. He's not someone I feel close to. He's not someone I have any particular urge to meet again. And yet he's the person who's changed my life more than anyone else. So how can that be? And in order to help you to kind of make the connection, to come with me, as it were, to come with me in my thinking, what I want to say is something about the Buddha himself. So the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago. I'm a Buddha. Gautama. Shakyamuni Buddha. He's the Buddha of our time. So he's a historic personage. He lived 2,500 years ago. We'll never get to meet him, but his work lives on. How does his work live on? What did he say that was so important? How do we know? Well, of course, his followers told their followers who told their followers who told their followers down the generations, and at some point they told some Tibetans somewhere, and those Tibetans told Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, lots of other people. And who did they tell? They told Bhante Sangharakshita. And who did he tell? Well, he told Ratnasuri. And who did she tell? Well, Ratnasuri told Maitreyi. And who did Maitreyi tell? She told me. So here I am, sitting at the feet of the Buddha. And it's a direct communication down through a lineage of traceable connections, through a process of ordination. Now, getting ordained is a big deal, I can tell you. You have to train for it for ages, and then you have to go through this kind of... Because in that process, what people are helping you to do is to find out who you are, what you want, and why you want it. And Maitreyi, who's my preceptor, I want to tell you a little bit about her. She wasn't ordained by Bhante. She was the follower of someone who was ordained by Bhante. So already we're two generations down when you're looking at me. But what happened with her? She was a friend of mine, in a way. And she taught Alexander technique, and I also learned to do Alexander technique. And... I wanted her to ordain me, and I wanted her to ordain me in 2002. And one day I went to her in her room and I said, Maitreyi, I'm ready. I know I am. I'm sure I am. I'm ready for ordination. And she said, looked at me, and she said, I'm not going to ordain you this year. And at that moment, something really weird happened. Sort of was disappointed, but what happened was this whole business of lineage was sort of activated. I really saw her not as my friend anymore, but as the person who had in their hand the lineage from the Buddha that she was going to give to me through ordination. It sort of was kind of like a magic moment where she was no longer her, and I was no longer me. And instead, there was a kind of interchange between us that was incredibly serious, but also profoundly significant and joyful. And this is, I suppose, an aspect of faith, if you like. Not belief in anything, but just trust. It has the quality of great friendship, but it has so much more besides. And something of that quality of connection, right back through the mists of time, is what I want to talk about now. Because there's a lovely story, which I think we've talked about even here, which is one of the followers of the Buddha. He was an old, old man. He was called Pingya. He couldn't get himself anymore. It was a bit like my dad, you know. He didn't, even with his Zimmer frame, he just couldn't get there to see the Buddha. And they said to him, well, you know, you love the Buddha so much, why don't you just get someone to take you to him? Why are you sitting here? Why aren't you with the Buddha? And he said, I don't need to go to the Buddha in person, in his body. He says, there's no moment for me that is spent away from Gautama Buddha, from this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding, this teacher whose teaching is the way things are, instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, with nothing quite like it anywhere in the world. That's how he described his connection with the Buddha. You see, sir, said Pingya, with constant and careful vigilance, it is possible for me to see him with my mind as clearly as with my eyes, in night as well as day. And since I spend my nights revering him, there is not, to my mind, a single moment spent away from him. Now, why am I reading you that? I'm reading you that because probably most of you will never get to see Bhante if you haven't seen him already. You'll never meet the man, probably. But it doesn't matter at all. What matters is that you make a connection with what is meaningful to you, what really helps you to get a grip on your life, what helps you to work on yourself, to change your life through the teachings that have passed down through this river of a lineage. So that's what you have to do. You have to make the connections for yourself with what is most meaningful to you. So the question is, can you connect on an imaginal level, both with yourself and your aspiration, but also with the teacher whose order and movement you are practicing with right now? You're here, not by accident, but by design. You come here on purpose. You come here on purpose to find out what it is that you can do that's most meaningful for you, most likely to help you to change your life. Well, to finish my talk, I want to tell you that the best way to revere a teacher is to pass on what the teacher told you clearly. So, to finish my talk, I want to tell you what I have learned from Bhante Sangharakshita about the heart of the Buddha Dharma, which is the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So what have I learned? Well, for the Buddha jewel, from the Diamond Sutra, it says, those who by my form, my body, did see me, and those who followed me by voice. Me, those people will not see. It's nothing to do with knowing Bhante Sangharakshita in person. That's not the message here. From the Dharma should one see the Buddha. From the Dharma bodies comes their guidance. Yet Dharma's true nature cannot be discerned, and no one can be conscious of it as an object. It's difficult, this Dharma. It's tricky. It's elusive. However, we have here in Bhante Sangharakshita one of the most clear teachers that has ever existed, probably. He's so clear, it's almost astounding. He never wastes a word. So if you want to study the Dharma, then this is what you need to do. If you want to know Bhante Sangharakshita, then this is what you need to do. Study the teachings. So if I were to sum up the Dharma for you, like I've summed up the Buddha for you, what would I say? What is the Dharma in a minute? Ah! Of course, we could talk for 100 years about the Dharma and we still wouldn't cover it. But for me, probably the most important thing, the core teaching for me personally, is the three marks, the three lakshanas of our conditioned existence. Yeah, we will suffer because we dislike the truth that things are not fixed, they're not permanent, and they're in a never-ending flux of change. We don't like it, it causes us suffering. As one of the great texts says, phenomena roll on and on. We don't like it, But that never-ending flux of change also includes us. We and all our stuff are impermanent and arise in dependence on other things. So once you start getting your head around that little pithy four lines in my notes, you get to finger pointing at the moon of the Dharma. And we resist all this truth. Why? We were talking about it in the tea break. Something's being challenged by this truth once you get down to it. Something is being challenged and it doesn't like it. Usually I think we probably call it the ego or something like that, or the self, but I'll leave that to another time. But then we realise, as I said earlier on, that we're probably a bit numb about who we are. We're certainly not very clear about what we want and we don't know how to get it. We need help, we need support, and we basically need each other. We need to get together in that wave of compassion that we experienced in the Metta Bhavana. We need to swim together in that. We need to trust that that wave of compassion is there for us, that we are not ever alone, while at the same time needing to take ultimate responsibility for our own growth and change. We are interconnected. We can care for each other. But we've also got to take personal responsibility. So Bhante says that he believes, that his most profound belief is that it's possible for any human being to communicate with any other human being and to feel for them and be friends with any other human being. Can you believe that yourself? You think, well, actually, it's their fault. No, it's nothing to do with me. That person is up. When you hear that, when you hear yourself even thinking that, then you stop and you think, ah, something's being challenged here. And this is the Sangha jewel in action. I want to finish with another image. We started with the image of Bhante Sangharakshita walking very deliberately down the road with his bottle of Neil's Yard shampoo. And I want to read you to finish his image of the esoteric Sangha. This is the liberated Sangha, the Sangha jewel which is present for all of us. He says, let us end with the image of space, the image of the sky, infinite in extent, deep blue in colour, and perfectly pure. In the midst of this image is another image. We see a figure flying through the sky. It is a naked red figure, a female figure. Her long black hair is streaming out behind her. Her face is uplifted in ecstasy, and there is a smile on her lips. She is what is known in Buddhist tradition as the Dakini, or Lady of Space, the embodiment of the spiritual energy of the Buddha. She is absolutely free. Free to fly in any direction, north, south, east, west, the zenith, the nadir. She is free even to remain still. Here is the liberty of infinite space. She enjoys the taste of freedom. Thank you very much.